Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Welcome back to another podcast episode. Thank you for being here. Now, before we dive into this incredible episode with Stacey, again, this is an episode you're going to want to pass along to a lot of friends, but we got to talk about our feet being our foundation. If you haven't checked out Vivo Barefoot Shoes yet, I really just recommend going and checking them out because not only are they cute and they look super good, especially for a lot of the barefoot brands out there, don't look as good. I'm just going to say that. These really are stylish. I get compliments on them all the time. But beyond all that superficial stuff, Vivo is doing so much to really give back to the earth, to give back to communities. And it's one of the reasons that we love them so much and we're so loyal. And I just have noticed such a change in my feet and my function, my awareness, my ability to spread has just continued to improve in my toes. And it's not just me, but they've shown studies that if you wear Vivo Barefoot shoes consistently for over 6 months, that you gain 60% more feet strength. And you guys, this is playing a role up the chain. This is playing a role to how your feet are functioning, what they're feeling and how they're responding as you're walking, lifting, running, anything, but also how you're feeling up the body. So how you're feeling from your Achilles to your shins, to your knees, your hips, your low back, everything. It's playing a role based on how our feet are functioning. So free your feet from shoes that stuff your toes, from shoes that just don't work, that give you this false sense of stability with this big, huge cushion on the heel that you don't need. You get to really come back to feeling your feet. So use our code, actually changed. So it used to be Optimal15, but don't use that anymore because it's not going to work. It's TOB15, which stands for the optimal body, right? So TOB15. The link is in the show notes. You can easily go check it out or just type in vivobarefoot.com. Use TOB15 at checkout. This only works on shoes that are not already discounted. And it's just favorite shoes. Compliments all around. My feet feel amazing. And I just, please check it out. Just do yourself a favor. Invest in your feet. Invest in your health. Okay, let's dive in. I'm so excited for this next interview. We have Dr. Stacey Sims, who is a PhD and applied researcher and innovator and entrepreneur in human performance, specifically talking about sex differences in training, nutrition, and environmental conditions. She actually has like her own hashtag, Women Are Not Small Men, which I absolutely love because it's not just all research, doesn't apply to everyone. And she is a huge person really speaking on educating on the differences in what happens in nutrition and training from a woman's standpoint, all the way from puberty to menopause to later in life. And we're going to discuss all of that on the podcast right now. She really has been named one of the top 50 visionaries in the running industry from DMSE Sports. She's been named one of the top 40 changing the paradigm of the field from Outside Magazine. She's named one of the top 4 visionaries in outdoor sports industry from a Genius Issue and Outside Magazine. And she's just named one of the top 4 individuals changing the landscape in triathlon nutrition by Triathlete Magazine. I mean, her research is really groundbreaking. And she's even worked for Stanford for a long time from 2007 to 2012, and just really helping to specialize in the sex differences with environmental and nutritional considerations for recovery and performance, specifically in women's health and performance. So I know that get your pens and paper ready because there's so much education that she drops on this podcast. You might have to listen to it a couple times, but so much good information here. Can't wait to dive in. Hi, Stacey. Thank you so much for joining us. I've really just from afar admired your work online. And again, the research and the education that you're providing, you know, especially with your hashtag, Women Are Not Small Men, I think is huge. So thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me. I was kind of laughing when you're like, will you be on the podcast? Because I've been following your stuff too. And I was like, yes, this is awesome.
Oh, thank you.
Well, we're so excited to have you on to talk through all this because we have tons of women that are following us and constantly get questions about menopause and diet and nutrition throughout the cycle or training throughout the cycle. And I know we're going to dive into tons of those specifics. One of the places we like to start is just to ask you, what makes you so passionate about continuing to forge forward in this area?
People who know me, and I've said this before, it's kind of a selfish driven thing. It started for me trying to figure out questions for me and my teammates, but now it expands because I have a daughter. And I want her world in sport and fitness to be completely different in an empowering way than it has been for me. And then also as, you know, I'm getting older and I have friends and training competitively and trying to compete. And they're like, what's going on? And there's no real information for that whole 40, 50 year old age set that is really applicable. So there's the two ends of the driver are there, particularly for people that I love.
Yeah, it's so true. And I know growing up as an athlete myself, you know, women who just didn't have their periods. It was kind of just something that was almost normal and not talked about enough.
Right, right. I can't tell you how many times I've heard women go, oh, I don't get my period, but that's okay, because then I don't have to worry about it. Or coaches will be like, I don't know what's happening. They probably don't have their period, but that's okay, because then that means they're trained enough. Mm. Like there's a huge misstep and misconception about what it means to have a regular menstrual cycle and what it means to have a healthy period.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I even heard that growing up, like that certain people didn't get their period because they were just too fit or something. Like they didn't really have an explanation for why that happened. But could you dice that apart a little bit more? Like why might some people who are training really heavily stop getting their menstrual period? And what's that mean?
Yeah, so there are two different scopes. Like if girls start training early and then they don't get their period, that's a primary amenorrhea. So that means like their endocrine system hasn't developed enough to really get some of the signalings to start the cycle. And that is an energy misstep where they're not eating enough for the training or they're not eating around the right times. So it delays the later stages of puberty. But then when we get into our late teens, 20s, even in our 30s, when the period stops, this is secondary hypothalamic amenorrhea. So what that means is there's a misstep in neurophysiology where you're not eating enough calories just to sit on the couch and watch Netflix, let alone go through your daily activities, let alone supply energy for training and adaptation. So then what happens when you don't get enough calories in is your body starts to downregulate all your resting metabolic rate goes down, your thyroid starts to get a hit. And one of the critical things is you stop having a luteinizing hormone pulse. And without that pulse, you don't have ovulation. Then without ovulation, you end up with no menstrual cycle. So it's a stopgap, really, a warning sign when women start to have menstrual cycle dysfunction and then their periods stop, that they're not eating enough to match what their training is, or they're not eating at the right times around their training to allow their body to understand that there's nutrition coming in to support that additional stress.
Mm, I think that's really interesting. Like not only the fact of not eating enough, but not eating at the right times. Can you dissect that a little bit more in terms of what that means?
When we exercise, it is more of a fasted state. Like we're using fuel and it's a complete breakdown state. So there's a signaling to use liver glycogen, use muscle glycogen, use free fatty acids, release hormones that are responsible for breaking down these particular components to fuel the muscle and to have enough fuel to meet the stress and demands that's coming on with resting or with your heart rate elevation, your respiratory rate going up, muscle contraction, all of those things. When you stop or you get past your exercise session, your body is still in this stressed breakdown state. If you don't eat within that 45-minute window to really stop the signaling for breakdown, you stay in this long catabolic or breakdown state. And what happens there is it's giving signals back to the brain, the hypothalamus, that we're under a lot of stress and we don't have the nutrients coming in to help overcome that stress. So we know that even if you eat enough in a 24-hour period, but you're not eating in and around training to stop that breakdown effect, you end up with the same symptomology as someone who's in a low energy state. And that's when someone's not eating enough, full stop. So the timing of food around training becomes really important, especially if you want to keep endocrine systems healthy and to keep regular cycles going. And if you're not overly concerned about that, which you should be, but the other aspect is adaptation. If you're not giving your body nutrition to stop that breakdown state, then there's no way your body's going to get the signaling to adapt to the stress that you just put on it. So then it's kind of a moot point to have done that exercise session.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that we should, or after training, try and eat or consume something within 45 minutes. Does it matter what? Like, what would be the ideal thing for somebody to eat after training?
Yeah. So for women, we really want to focus on some protein with some carbohydrate. We end up using more free fatty acids and not as much stored carbohydrate. We use a lot of blood glucose during exercise, which comes from the liver, but not so much from the muscles compared to men. And we also break down a lot of amino acids. So we need to have protein first with a little bit of carbohydrate to really knock that signaling on the head. And it doesn't have to be massive. Like, if you are looking at monitoring calories for a slight calorie restriction and weight loss, then you're splitting your meal and you're having the bulk of your breakfast after a morning training session, but you've had something beforehand. If you're looking at trying to gain lean mass, you need a little bit more abundance because you can't build mass without abundance. So this is where you're looking at having a little bit extra, where you're having a single serve of low-fat Greek yogurt with some honey or maple syrup, or you're having a protein smoothie that you're making with different protein powders and chia seeds, flax seeds, banana. So it's having the components of around 30 grams of protein and around 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrate. So it's not a massive amount, but it is critical to get those macronutrients in to really signal the body to, yeah, sweet, we have nutrition coming in, we can adapt, we can stop the breakdown state, we can get into that full recovery, so then the next time you hit it, you can hit it hard.
Yeah, I think that's so important to even just continue to remember, like, directly after working out. And another thing that I've heard before, and I just, you know, those things that you hear about how long it takes in consuming, like, say you had a protein shake and you just down it right away rather than actually consuming it like a meal and having it over at least 10 to 15 minutes. Is there a difference in consuming it like all at once or consuming it over time?
Not a huge difference, no. It ends up being gastric emptying rate. If you're putting a huge volume of fluid in at once, you might have a more rapid gastric emptying rate, but then it sits in the intestines and it titrates out for even energy. If you're sipping over the course of 10, 15 minutes, then you're going to have more of an even scope into the intestines and still have that same kind of even energy release into the bloodstream. So, I mean, some people are like, I got to get it in because I've got to go somewhere. And other people are like, okay, well, I'll slow down and I'll have it. It also comes around satiation as well. If you're drinking something really quickly and then boom, you're out the door, your body might not have the same signaling effect on the brain that you've had food to make you feel full. Whereas if you're drinking it over the course of 15 minutes, then you have more of the time for the reactions to come into the brain to signal, yeah, okay, we're having some food, I'm not hungry. But it doesn't interfere with your actual recovery.
I think that's a lot of what one of our friends definitely pushes when she says, hey, if you're having a smoothie or having, you know, a protein shake, just drink it a little more slowly, especially for that satiation bit. And so then, like you said, your gastric emptying, your stomach doesn't just empty really quickly and then you might have some hunger again or something like that. So that definitely makes sense. But good to break down the myth that you're still absorbing all those nutrients. So if you're in a hurry, feel free to chug that shake as fast as you need to.
Yeah, get it in.
Right, just to get it in. But so that's good to know about, you know, timing for just eating after training. I know that there are also different considerations throughout the cycle, depending on where you're at. And I'm wondering if you can try and I know this is something you could probably talk about for an hour, yeah. but based on where you're at in the cycle, does that change or just diet in general? Do you need to have different focus?
I can give the Cliff Notes version. Great. So pull out the old college Cliff Notes. So if we're talking about a menstrual cycle, the way I explain it for ease is that if you open a textbook, you have a 28-day cycle. And we know that women are completely different. Like, no one's really set in that 28 days. But for ease of explanation, we say day one is the first day bleeding, all the way to around day 12, 13, which is ovulation. And then after ovulation, from day 14 to day 28 is the luteal phase or the high hormone phase. So when we scope it of looking at how nutrition changes across that, in the low hormone phase or day one to around day 12, right before ovulation, a woman can access carbohydrate a little bit better. Her overall baseline cortisol levels are lower, so you don't have as much muscle breakdown. You have more plasma volume, so you have more water in the blood. So we're more, quote, like men. So our nutrition there is more taking care of the gut microbiome, where we're eating lots of fibrous fruit and veg. We're having good hits of lean protein, regular doses across the day. Carbohydrate, you don't have to worry so much about taking carbohydrate during training because your body can access it a little bit better. But once you hit ovulation, you have the estrogen surge. This is where things start to change. We know that with an estrogen surge, estrogen has some changes within the muscle itself where it inhibits a lot of the glycogen from being used. So we end up with more free fatty acid use. When we get after ovulation into the high hormone phase, when progesterone comes up, this is where things really start to get interesting in the fact that progesterone takes carbohydrate and shuttles it to the building endometrial lining because the endometrium is super heavy and thick with glycogen. The other thing that progesterone does is it breaks down muscle tissue and it breaks down other fat tissues to provide the building blocks for the endometrial lining. Our metabolic rate also goes up because we're building tissue. So when we get into that high hormone phase, we need to think about the fact that we need more sources of magnesium. We need more sources of protein. And if we're going to do any kind of high intensity, we need to supply carbohydrate before and during exercise in order to hit those high intensities. So it's when you're looking across the scope, it's after ovulation, you have to pay a little bit more attention to what you're doing specifically around protein requirements and your training and what kind of training you're doing in order to maximize those benefits if you're doing high intensity.
And I love learning about this stuff just so that I continue to educate myself and my body. And I know that when I really was paying attention, we had like a little chart on,
it was
on
great.
The fridge.
Especially because I cook and it was great to have that on the fridge so I knew kind of what foods I should try mixing in more often.
Awesome.
And I really did feel a difference though coming up to even the symptoms and having cramping or anything like it significantly reduced when I really was mindful of the types of foods that I was getting in and during the time of my cycle. So it was so beneficial when you really start doing it. I know you have more courses on this that people can look into as well. The other thing, what if you say you were an athlete and lost your period and now you're trying to get it back, you know? So what is the I know this is going to be different for everyone, but is there food recommendation that you really, or training style that you really recommend women start to focus on in order to gain that period back?
There are two things that we need to consider. If I need to make it really definitively clear that I am sitting on the fine line between health and performance, because I'm a female athlete performance physiologist. So if we were to go into one of my working group meetings where we have GPs and endocrinologists, and then the other side is pure performance physiologists, and you say, okay, what's the recommendation for someone who's amenorrheic? The medical side will say immediately stop everything that they're doing and they need to eat more. The physiology side of things will be like, oh, no. We can just moderate the training and we can keep them going. I sit in the middle and go, well, we can't have everyone stop completely for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. For me, working with high performance athletes who might have contracts and they can't stop because that's their livelihood. Or we look at this huge group of women that use exercise for stress release. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have exercise, then mental health takes a massive, massive hit. So we can't have them stop either. So we look in the middle, and what we find works is taking the focus off the fuel depleting workouts, like long endurance stuff. We put it on strength training, and we know that strength training in itself is not completely fuel depleting, but it is still beneficial in the fact that you are building lean mass, you are able to get endorphin rush, you get that stress relief, and then after your period comes back, you have this massive amount of strength to build on. It's not to say you're not doing cardio, it's just you're very tapered in what kind of cardio you're doing. You're not doing a lot of high intensity work. If you are, it's very focused, and you're eating in and around every training session. The other thing that people really need to realize in the carbohydrate fearing world that we're still in and the fasting hungry world that we are in is that women should not fast because when we start looking at fasted training, this increases cortisol. It also signals areas in the brain that are specific in the hypothalamus to say, hey, wait a second, we don't have nutrition coming in. We need to start shutting things down. Whereas men only have one area in the brain that's sensitive to that. Women have two, and it's specific to kisspeptin neurons. We have two areas because we need enough nutrition coming in to get that luteinizing hormone pulse, and that takes a lot of energy. And we have another area in the brain that's responsible for our metabolic rate and our endocrine health. We know that from different studies that when people start fasting and their nutrient intake comes down, especially when women lose their periods, then it's a signal for the body to put on fat. And we've seen this from rat models all the way to human models. So no fasted training is super, super important. The other thing is carbohydrate. Women need carbohydrate. So if you're trying to get your periods back, you need to boost energy intake, especially in and around training. Like I described before, we want to make sure the body stays out of that breakdown state as much as possible. So of course, you're going to be in it when you're doing some training, but you have to fuel for it. The other thing is you can't be afraid of carbohydrate because if you don't have enough carbohydrate, you're not going to stimulate that kisspeptin area in the brain that brings that luteinizing hormone back. And if I'm working with athletes who have lost their period and they want to get it back, and I look and say, oh man, we need to up your calorie intake by about 1,000 calories a day, this freaks people out. Mm-hmm. It would freak me out if someone told me, oh, you need to eat an extra 1,000 calories a day. So when we're looking at fueling in and around training, it's really easy to get that extra 1,000 calories in without having a negative impact on body composition, because that becomes the biggest fear for a lot of women, that it's going to interfere with performance, it's going to interfere with body composition. But what we find is when you start fueling for performance, your performance improves, your body composition improves, and you can get your period back. So again, it comes down to the timing and really what you're eating to supply to your body when it's under a shitload of stress, which is what exercise is. So if I'm talking to the medical groups and I'm saying, hey, you know, we know our athletes need to eat more, but we also know that they can't stop. This is the plan. We're going to taper volume and intensity. We're going to increase the strength component, and we're going to make sure that our women are fueling appropriately in and around each session to bring their total calorie and carbohydrate intake up. And it's taken quite a few case studies for them to say, oh, wow, this actually works. But we see it. We just saw the entire New Zealand rowing team who effectively were in full red S and had no periods 3 years ago to implementing this and coming out of the blue to win gold because they were all eating. They felt good. They had optimal body composition and their power went up.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's just incredible the way that food has gotten such a negative stigma, but it's so critical for all the things that people are searching for in the training and fitness world, which is better health outcomes, better body composition, more energy, And then you have all these buzzwords about, you know, no carbohydrate, ketogenic diet, fasting. And if you're amenorrheic, well, we don't really talk about it so much because it just happens, but it shouldn't happen.
Yeah, that is so, so incredibly huge. And even it has to change as we change and as we age. And I know, like, for example, for my mom right now, she is obviously past menopause and it's just, she fasts a lot. She has like one meal a day, really, maybe a couple, but really she's like, oh, I do the one meal a day and I feel great and I feel good. Everyone should do this. And it's like, well, no, not everyone is in that state that you are.
Right. Does she do any training?
She does. Yeah. She hikes a ton. She loves walking.
She's just really active overall. Yeah.
Yeah.
Immediately my head goes, oh man, I'd like to see her DEXA, her blood work. Yeah. I'd like to see her sleep metrics, all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, you hear it where people are like, oh, I feel fantastic when I'm doing intermittent fasting or time restricted eating. And I do my fasted training and I go to work. And then I'm like, I want to see all the stuff.
Yeah.
And then you see the stuff, you're like, your sleep is not there. Like you get hypoglycemic while you're sleeping. So you don't get into slow wave reparative sleep or REM sleep. You have lots of disruptions. You're probably cranky at work if you ask your coworkers because you haven't been eating. And then looking at bone density and blood parameters and the potential that you're missing out on, even when you're hitting menopause.
Yeah.
I think a lot of just talking about these two, like we kind of are throwing out a lot of fads here about like, fasting or intermittent fasting or low carb, keto, carnivore diets. And even in the research world, when we do get data on some of these types of diets, I know this is something that you're a huge advocate for. Like a lot of the research is done on men or, you know, they exclude certain populations because, oh, women are complicated because they have this menstrual cycle and we can't isolate all the hormone release and stuff like that. So, I mean, do you think that's an issue that a lot of them just get pushed popularly in like the media or what have you because of these specific benefits that we can get? And a woman's like, they may feel benefit after a few days, but it's just not something that the female body has been built to sustain.
Right. So it is partly the male data thing. But then the other thing that is endemic just in our culture is the fact that if something works in a clinical environment, it gets picked up by the fitness environment and gets pushed out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when we're looking at things, how most of these diets started, if you're looking at the ketogenic diet, you're looking at intermittent fasting, low carb, high fat, they all started in a clinical situation for a purpose where you had obese or diabetic individuals that needed blood sugar control and weight loss rapidly before surgery. Or, you know, you have people with traumatic brain injury and they're finding that the ketogenic diet works really well because of different aspects of brain metabolism. And then the outfall is the change of body composition. And that's where the fitness industry comes in. Not only do they not pay attention to the fact that it's not transferable from a clinical population to a healthy population, but they also don't pay attention to the fact that, yeah, it's mainly male data. And then when you transfer it over to women, there's sex differences from birth. It's not just a hormonal flux. I mean, there's differences from epigenetic exposure of estrogen within the womb. There's sex differences within the muscle mitochondria, sex differences in the amount of creatine that's stored and how your body uses it. So there's so many different things that are ignored when you're transferring it over into the fitness world, which is probably why the fitness and supplement world is such a billion-dollar industry, because women are the primary buyers and women are the primary target for all of these different fads.
Oh, yeah. It is so problematic in terms of how we view it and then what gets thrown around, especially now with social media. Just if one person popular is posting about something, right, it starts to go viral that way. What are some of the ones that, especially in this diet world, that you would say, I really recommend women staying away from some of the popular trends?
All of them.
Love it.
Because, I mean, the most simplistic thing is going back to regular eating.
Yeah.
Because then you're incorporating the fasting aspect of 12-hour overnight fast, right? So you're going to get all the health advantages. And that doesn't interfere with training adaptation, because if you're eating before you go training, boom, you've got some food. If we're looking at plant-based, that's great because you're affecting the gut microbiome in a positive way. some people end up with a little bit of deficiency. So there's hits and misses there. But when you're looking at all the other fads, they're really exclusionary. Like they're taking food groups and they're making them the evil part, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking about ketogenic, low carb, high fat, it's all exclusionary, not sustainable. And when we come right back down to basic physiology and the way that our bodies operate, we need to really look at what's happening with the gut microbiome. So if you're looking at ketogenic diet, where are you getting the really good fibrous types of fruit and veg that feed the good gut bacteria that's essential for so many of our vitamin cofactors, brain function, mood, immune system, hormone function? Same thing with low carb, high fat. And when we're disseminating down to body composition as well, it's really important that you have a strong gut microbiome with lots of diversity so that you don't get the overgrowth of some of the bacteria that causes obesity, that causes you to hold on to more body fat. And it's more complex than just following a diet trend. And it's more complex than the generalization of what people should follow or not follow, because we do have individual variations. But the basic premise is, have a look at the health outcomes of where you want to be when you're 80. Like, is what you're doing now going to be beneficial along the way as you're looking at bone composition, mood, energy levels, muscle integrity, cardiovascular health, blood vessel health, all of those things? In short term, sure, maybe you'll look great. Maybe you maybe not feel great. But long term, how sustainable it is to be a healthy, functioning 80-year-old?
Yeah, I think that's so important to point out that a lot of these fads, I mean, they just aren't sustainable. And diet isn't something that happens over a 1 month span. Our diet is something that we develop over a lifetime. And if we're not going into any sort of change in what we consume with that mindset that, hey, these changes are things that I want to continue developing over a lifetime of finding a consistent diet that works best for me, I don't think it's something that we should approach, especially because we are changing over a lifetime and certain diets and certain exercise styles aren't going to be the same. So I'm going to ask a huge task of you again to condense a 3-hour lecture into a couple minutes on menopause, because I know that's a massive topic that we want to touch on a little bit more, and the premenopausal, perimenopausal, postmenopausal considerations that women may need to have in their mind. So do you have a Cliff Notes version of that?
I do. So I think most people are very aware of puberty and premenopause, the reproductive years, but a lot of people aren't really aware of what perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause are. So just for clarity, perimenopause are the years that are about 5 or 6 years before menopause. And menopause is actually just one point on the calendar that marks 12 days of, or 12 months of no period. So it can be like the birthday on the calendar that celebrates the fact that you're now in this new phase of life. Every year after that one point in time is postmenopause. When we think about menopause and that term that's used broadly in so many different areas, we have this image that comes up of women who have like a pot belly, Dowager's hump, not so strong. And we see that as a definitive point of age. Whereas we see men who are around that 50-year mark, and they don't have that image in society at all, because men age in a linear fashion. So when we're looking at perimenopause, which are the years leading up to menopause, it can start in your late 30s or 40s. A lot of women will start to feel effects when they're around 45, 46, where all of a sudden the training and nutrition that they've been following up to this point is not working for them anymore. They're finding that they are not recovering well. They might be, quote, squishy overnight, putting on more belly fat. They can't build lean mass. They're starting to have soft tissue injury. They're starting to have lots of joint inflammation, changes with biomechanics, a lot of mood issues. And they're like, what is going on? And most of the time it's getting chalked up to things like high stress, because this is also the time where women are hitting it high in their career. They might have kids that are either teenagers or going through issues themselves. They might have older parents they have to worry about, household, all of that stuff gets wrapped up. But the undercurrent is the levels of our hormones are changing. We're approaching what we call ovarian failure. So we'll have times where estrogen is high. We'll have times when estrogen progesterone ratios are relatively normal. But women's periods and menstrual cycle is pretty much on the same schedule it has been. It's just that some are anovulatory, so we don't have progesterone. Some are a huge surge of estrogen, so the ratios are a little bit different. Women are a little bit more estrogen dominant. And when we're looking at how these hormones are changing, they affect every cell in the body. So we know that we're having issues with building lean mass because if we don't have the signaling between estrogen and progesterone, then we aren't going to get the signaling to build lean mass. We also are going to get a signaling for more inflammation. We have the signaling for putting more visceral fat down. So that's the abdominal adiposity that we often see. There's changes in neurotransmitters. So this is why we have a lot of mood changes from estrogen affecting serotonin. And so it's all this quagmire of stuff that's happening. Then when you get to postmenopause, this is where people think all the changes happen, but they've already happened. So now people are like, oh, let's study postmenopausal women because now we have a higher risk factor of obesity, low bone density, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. But in fact, all those changes have already happened and they're in that state. So we're looking at what we need to do from a training and nutrition standpoint is we now need to change our training up to give our body the stress that these hormones used to support. So what I mean by that is we need to really, really polarize our training. So we see a lot of women that fall into, I'm going to be a great ultra distance athlete now because the body is really, really attuned to going long and slow and burning fat. But that is not beneficial for so many of the health outcomes and the body composition changes that women want. So we need to take that moderate intensity stuff out. We need to be able to hit the top end with high intensity sprint intervals, plyometrics for power development. We need to lift heavy stuff because we need that neuromuscular stimulus. We need to maintain strength in order to get power and speed and the stimulus for building lean mass. And then we also need to factor in more recovery days. So we need some of that really super embarrassingly slow, just pure recovery for parasympathetic activation. So when we start looking at the polarized training, we start seeing differences in mood. We start seeing better outcomes for body composition, strength. And then when we look at the nutrition layering on it, we know that women need more protein as we age. We also know we need more protein post-exercise to help with the stimulus of lean mass development. So we're looking more at that 40-gram dose post-exercise in order to get enough circulating amino acids to help with the stress of exercise to stimulate lean mass development, as well as to help the brain with some of the central nervous system fatigue that lingers after exercise. So when we're talking about the tightness of perimenopause, this is where all the changes happen. And this is where we need to address those changes in order to make the rest of the biological state of women so much easier and better and fitter.
That is so huge because I feel like training almost slows down, you know, oh, I get more aches and pains when I'm in my 40s and I don't want to do plyometrics or I'm afraid of interval and higher intensity exercises. And so it almost starts to shift more toward, let me just do some light, moderate and low impact exercise. You know, it feels like that's what a lot of people want. Where what you're saying or what I'm hearing is that the physiology is actually wanting a little bit different. We want load. We want stimulus. We want those days of high intensity. And so I love that you're saying that because hopefully it's also allowing the permission for people to push into the uncomfortable. And it's okay to stress your body a little bit and your body's got you. And the stronger that you get, you know, the more that those aches and pains can go away. So I love hearing this, learning it myself, and it's incredible how much information that you're able to put in like 5 minutes there.
Well, and like you said, it's with that increased intensity, we still need that polarization because, you know, as we age, the recovery time might be a little bit increased. And I think sometimes that's why people want to shy away from that because they'll do something really intense and then they'll be like, I'm wrecked for like 2 days. But that's that's kind of the point. Now we need to allow for that recovery and that polarization like you're bringing up. So I think it's so important to allow people to, like you said, move into the discomfort and a little bit of that soreness.
Exactly. That's the thing. And then when you look at like the guidelines and people are like, oh, I'm hitting menopause and my doctor told me to do X, Y, Z. And it's all about 150 minutes of moderate to low intensity exercise. Mm-hmm. I was like, no, if you're starting from nothing, that's okay. But when you start from a background of being able to move and move well, you need to just push on, do the intensity, drop the volume, because that's how you're going to get better and have a quality of life when you get a little bit into your, like, I am, my grandmother's 105 and she gets up and does wall push-ups and chair sits every day.
Wow.
Right. I want to be like her.
That's I want the amazing. Strength.
Yeah. And people are afraid of slowing down. And we know from some recent studies that it's not about the neuromuscular aspect actually slowing down. It's the fact that we lose strength. Mm-hmm. So we need to keep the strength component and put a huge emphasis on resistance training, both for just daily life, but also to maintain performance.
So I know we talked a lot about perimenopause in terms of the training. Does that maintain? Do you recommend that through postmenopause as well?
Yeah. So I tell people you're setting yourself up in perimenopause when your body is still somewhat aware of what high intensity is, and then you can just move on through. Mm. When you're looking at women who have been doing long, slow stuff, and now all of a sudden they hit menopause and they're like, oh gosh, now what? Then you have to phase in some of that high intensity. So you're working on functional movement. You're working on learning how to lift. You're looking on doing really short, sharp intervals so that they know what that top end feels like. So it's not like all of a sudden you're throwing someone into a boot camp or a plyometric session and saying, go for gold. It's learning, and also the body learns to move through that higher intensity work as well.
One thing I really want to highlight too, I mean, you brought up your 105-year-old grandma, which is amazing that she's still that active, is what high intensity means for an individual. And of course, you know, you work with really high level athletes. And so we're talking kind of from that scope of a high level athlete, but high intensity can mean a lot of different things. Like you kind of mentioned, for somebody who might not be doing as much activity right now. So knowing where your own scope is of that high intensity mark can be important, because we're throwing out different things like HIIT workouts or interval type stuff. And that can just seem intimidating to some people, but your interval might be a lot different than someone else's.
Right. So it is relative. Like if you've been a power walker, then you might throw in a couple of 20 second jogs, and that's high intensity to your body. Mm-hmm. If you have never been in the weight room before and you're like, I know I need to start, but I don't know how to start, then you start with body weight and learn how to move, because then again, that is intensity to your body. So yeah, it is very relative. And then some days your body is just like, I can't hit, I can't do intensity. There's no way, I'm too tired. And then you listen to your body. And I think people have not gotten into listening and using rating of perceived exertion, where I try to tell people on a scale of 1 to 10, 1, you're sitting down, 10, you're sprinting for your life, right? So if we're going to go out and do a sprint session, I want those sprints to be around an 8. So you might be on the verge of sprinting for your life, but you're not going to fall down vomiting and go, ugh. So being able to get people more in tune with how they feel so they can do intensity according to their own body. Mm-hmm. I sometimes use heart rate monitors, because people are very unaware of what low intensity means, because they're so used to moderate intensity. So using heart rate monitors to get them to understand what low intensity means, and then do a couple of sprints to see what that feels like as well. So it is a little bit of education, and it is definitely relative to each individual.
Hopefully people can start to feel more comfortable starting to explore that. I also know that you have a study right now, right? monitoring heart rate variability. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Heart rate variability is a marker of stress and recovery. So when heart rate variability goes down, it's an indication that our body is not being very resilient to stress. And it is definitely used to look at recovery metrics in people who are training consistently. It's also a mark of parasympathetic activation. So if you have a higher heart rate variability, then that means your body can get into that rest and digest state, especially during sleep. So we did a bit of a data dive, we being some of my colleagues at Whoop and myself, and looked at menstrual cycle variations with heart rate variability, as well as women who are using a combined oral contraceptive pill and those who are using a progestin only pill. And we know from previous research that heart rate variability does change across the natural menstrual cycle, because when progesterone goes up after ovulation, it increases sympathetic drive, it increases respiratory rate, it increases resting heart rate. So of course, your body is reflecting that and your heart rate variability goes down, which is an indication that you're not really recovered and you're not getting into that parasympathetic state. But when we're looking at women who are on an oral contraceptive pill, it changes that scope, where the first few days of the active pill, it looks like you're really well recovered. Your heart rate variability is really high. You have really good metrics of recovery. But for every subsequent day and week that you're on the combined pill, your heart rate variability gets lower and lower, and your recovery metrics reflect that. Until around day three of the placebo week, where then all of a sudden it looks like you're recovered again because you've had this washout. When women are using the progestin-only pill, they also look more like the naturally cycling woman, with really good recovery HRV metrics, until the last few days of the luteal phase. And this is where they differ from naturally cycling women, where the progestin component actually modulates natural progesterone, so you have better recovery. So understanding how your hormone profile affects recovery metrics is another thing that people need to be aware of, especially if they're working with a coach or they're trying to interpret how they feel on a particular day. Should I go hard? Should I not? Just understanding that sex hormones directly affect recovery because they directly affect your parasympathetic nervous system.
I think that's so important. And heart rate variability is, of course, this emerging thing over like the past decade that people have been finding is more and more important in measuring our ability to recover. So knowing that what you might be using for contraceptive could impact your recovery throughout the cycle and throughout the month is so important. And I mean, I just want to thank you first off for being here with us and all of the information that you've dumped out there. I know you have so much more that people can go to take courses and learn themselves. And I would encourage anybody out there who wants to learn more about themselves, their own body, their cycle, but also as a man who is the partner to a woman who loves to move a lot and who eats, of course, and who is also a provider. And I have been a coach to athletes before. I think that this information is so, so, so important for men who are in that system, who want to be able to have comfortable, supportive conversations with their female clients, with their female patients about their cycle and where they're at and how they can find better resources, even if I may not be the one to directly help them. I want to know how to have those conversations with them and how to send them to the right professional. And I think that all men who are either partners or all people who are partners to a female who's just a female in general should definitely know these things so that they can be a good ally.
I'm jumping up and down and clapping my hands, but you can't see because men are so vital to this conversation, right? And when the more men that are open and talking about it, the more empowering it is because it normalizes the conversation. So thank you so much for being part of this conversation and embracing it. It's fantastic.
Absolutely. And I was very lucky. I had a dad who was family practice doctor who delivered babies. He specialized in OB, and I was very used to having conversations about penises and vaginas and baby making growing up, and he didn't shy away from that stuff. So
awesome.
Yeah.
My kid has that kind of language too, and sometimes I feel bad. But she'll ask me a question. I'm completely honest, and she'll hear me doing podcasts or lectures, and she's like, every time I hear period or menstrual cycle, mama, I think about you. I'm like, great.
She knows. That's awesome, though. I mean, again, this work and what you're doing to help for the future of women athletes in particular, too, and just women as we go through life is so incredibly huge. So where can people go in order to, I mean, obviously we're going to have it linked up. You guys should check out our show notes so you can click on the links right now and check out Stacey's book, her website, her courses, so many things.
Yeah. So the website has all the stuff that's coming up and like the study we were talking about and a couple other things. And then you can always follow me on social, Dr. Stacey Sims on Instagram and Facebook. And then if you're into more the academic scope, my Twitter account is more the academic account. But that one's completely different from Dr. Stacey Sims. It's Summer Stack. Because I just try to keep a little bit away from more of the, so I can be a little bit more geeky in the science when I do that one.
Nerd out a little bit.
Yeah.
I love that. Stacey, thank you again just so much. Your information is absolutely incredible. I hope people had a pen and paper out for all of that or get to listen again because you dropped so much knowledge in this amount of time. So we're very, very grateful. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Like Jen said, I hope that you were taking down notes that entire interview. There was so much great information and actionable takeaways to go and help you optimize your health or help you help your partner optimize their health along their journey, no matter where they're at in their life cycle. Check out Dr. Stacey Sims and some of the products that she has. I know that it would be able to benefit tons of you out there. And of course, if you found something valuable or know somebody else who might benefit from this, please share it out. That's the best way for this to get in the hands of more people who can then optimize their health. And of course, we're going to be coming at you with tons more PT for Girls and interviews. Let us know if you ever have any suggestions and can't wait to see you next week.